KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Berkeley.
Berkeley,
California.
Oh, right north of the LeConte Street.
Coming up, does all the recent rain and flooding mean the drought is over?
We have to be prepared for a different kind of climate, and we have to understand that one wet year doesn't get us out of our bigger water problems.
Then one San Jose woodworker finds beauty in doing things the hard and imperfect way.
I tell the people, all I can offer you is my humanity, you know, and that it will look like a human being made it. I guarantee that.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's audiograph mystery sound.
Somasni ust, kyeria pust.
Eat, drink, and be merry. Cross Currents is next. Federal drought report released last week says only 9% of California is still in a drought. And if you've been paying attention to the weather over the past few months, you'd believe it.
Some breaking news tonight. Within the past 30 minutes, an evacuation advisory has been issued for the entire area along Coyote Creek, north of Interstate 280 and south of Highway 237. Now, the creek there is still rising. A flood warning has also been issued until further notice.
We have an estimate on winter storm flood damage across California. Right now, it's looking like at least $50 billion. SkyDrone 5 giving us an exclusive look in one hard-hit area. These some amazing images of the Pfeiffer Canyon Bridge.
Today, engineers got a closer look at the huge hole in the Oroville Dam spillway. This was the scene yesterday when a CBS 13 viewer captured this video of chunks of concrete flying through the air.
A year ago, this type of weather was almost unimaginable. Almost all areas of the state were in a very severe drought. But does all this rain mean California's water woes are over? KALW's energy and environment reporter Angela Johnston has more.
If you stand on the edge of the Almaden Dam in San Jose right now, you can feel the ground violently shaking and vibrating beneath your feet. That's the result of thousands of cubic feet of water rushing out of the reservoir, down into a creek, flowing into the bay. The water's being released to keep the reservoir from overflowing, because this spring, it's been really, really full.
Yeah, really full.
That's Ken Stumpf. He's a hydrographer for the Santa Clara Valley Water District, which owns this reservoir. Stumpf measures and manages the water here by looking at how many steel poles stick out of the water.
There's probably 100 of them at least, and they go down by 2-foot increments all the way down into the reservoir. And then we simply take a tape measure and measure down to the water surface.
Today, there are only 4 poles showing. Last year was pretty different. This reservoir became a sort of poster child for the drought. It was barely 5% full. So low that strange things usually buried beneath the water resurfaced.
You could see all the old cars that were, there was a couple of cars in there, but basically a little puddle.
A rusty old Ford Pinto buried halfway beneath cracked mud. And it sounded a lot different here than it does now.
It'd be just trickling, just enough to keep the watershed wet.
But Stumpf isn't celebrating the end of the drought.
We're always in a drought. You know, we live in a Mediterranean climate.
Which means, he says, we get a bunch of rainfall at once.
Or we get nothing at all.
We just happen to be in a wet year. The water policy folks, they seem to agree.
If you think of drought as only rainfall, one could argue the drought is over. But I think that's a mistake. I think that's the wrong way to think about it.
Peter Glick runs the Pacific Institute and has been studying water issues in California for decades.
The real question is, do we have enough water in California to do the things we want to do? And the unfortunate reality is that even in a wet year, like this year, we have water problems.
He says there are still rural towns without clean drinking water and fish in the bay that don't have enough fresh water to survive. And we're letting stormwater go down the drain. And Californians pumped way too much groundwater during the drought.
We take too much out. We use more groundwater than nature naturally recharges, even in a wet year. And that is simply unsustainable.
This is a huge problem in the Central Valley. You know, that part of the state that produces almost all your fruits and vegetables and dairy and meat. There's a new law requiring groundwater management, but people have 20 years to start implementing it. The good news, says Glick, is that there are simple solutions out there.
And they're cheaper, and they're faster, and they're more environmentally sound than the traditional things that we did in the last century.
Like pumping aquifers and building dams, which he says can have implications even for the Bay Area. One center for a lot of these new solutions? Stanford University. That's where Dr. Richard Luthi is overseeing creative projects like parks that capture stormwater.
Think of a park that has a pond, maybe a big pond.
Built so that the rainwater from all the surrounding neighborhoods will flow down into it.
But what this park-like feature is doing is holding water for a period of time, then running it through some wetlands, and then from there through some final filters before it goes in the ground.
They're actually testing this idea right now in Los Angeles, near the Burbank Airport. But this kind of park wouldn't work everywhere in the Bay Area.
Like, I live on the Stanford campus, and as people would know who are gardeners, if you try to plant a shrub or something, you dig down a few feet, and it's just this Santa Clara adobe clay.
Water won't seep through that soil so well. But Livermore, Sonoma, South San Jose, they all have the right soil for percolating parks. Luthi says there are plenty of innovative projects other cities could take on.
Another thing we could do is to take our wastewater and treat it to a high degree and then reuse it.
Luthi drives me to a corner of campus to show me what he means.
And this is where about half the sewage on the Stanford campus goes.
We're at the Cotega Resource Recovery Center. It looks like a boiler room without walls. A series of pumps and tanks and machines recycle wastewater from the campus.
The campus produces about 1 million gallons of wastewater a day.
Luthi says this project demonstrates that Stanford has the ability to capture half of that.
500,000 gallons a day will give us water security for the foreseeable future. I like to say it's our water security for the rest of the century.
Think of the wastewater that comes into the system as a cup full of jam, coffee grounds, sand, and water all mixed together. After sitting and sieving and scraping away, the coffee grounds and sand filter out, but the jam is left. How do they get rid of the jam? They feed it to bacteria. The final result? Water that isn't safe to drink just yet, but safe to use on lawns or to fill up lakes on campus. This treatment plant's tiny compared to most municipal ones. It's not quite mobile, but Luthi says most cities could set these up without having to dig up streets, adding to water supplies everywhere.
You could think of it as like a satellite plant. In other words, it's not reclaiming water at the big plant, but further away, further into the city where the water is generated and needed, and that saves the pumping cost.
Luthi says if we keep working on innovations like these, when the next drought comes along, and yes, there will be another one, when reservoirs like the one we visited earlier don't sound like this, we'll be more prepared. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
If you've got a question or a story idea about the drought, send an email to environment@klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Deep in the heart of high-tech Silicon Valley, there's a woodworker who chops, shaves, and carves almost entirely by hand. Bernie Ross makes complex dolls, musical instruments, and furniture, and he's on a mission. By bringing newbies into his garage-turned-woodshop, he's hoping to keep his art form alive. Reporter Leslie Griffey met up with Ross to learn about what he does and why he's trying to pass it on to another generation.
I call it an eggplant ukulele, and then it has fishtail peg heads. So it's my fishtail eggplant ukulele. My name is Bernie Ross. I am a woodworker and woodworking mentor. Of course, I make furniture and practical things, so form versus function, a lot of aesthetic things that are can't sit on them or put a plate on them, like dolls and marionettes and ukuleles. And I've made tenor lutes and mandolins and a banjo. It's a really basic instrument. It's like a Jaws harp or Jew's harp, you know, kind of like that. But, you know, and all of my artist friends, it's just like, it's an addiction. You just have to create. I've been collecting hand tools and power tools. All my power tools are what I call from the golden age of power tools, which is the 1930s through about the 1970s or so. You know, for lack of a better way of putting it, you do more woodworking with hand tools, whereas with power tools, it's zip, zip. It's aerobic, you know, when you're planing and you're chopping, and you develop a very intimate relationship with it. You know, I think that there is kind of a yearning for the something that's solid and handmade, you know, handmade and feels that way. And I tell the people, all I can offer you is my humanity, you know, and that it will look like a human being made it. I guarantee that. you know, I want to leave something. I've spent so many years, so many decades learning this, that I really want to pass on my skills and knowledge. I have a responsibility, since I know this, to give it to people who want to know it.
My name is Amy Curdock, and I am here because I'm trying to be a ninja woodworker with Bernie.
Would you like to make Christmas presents?
Yes.
All right, let's do that. So, Amy is going to use a large bowl gouge, and she's going to make a square piece round. So, it's called truing up the piece, yeah. Turning into a cylinder.
So there was a mulberry tree that meant a lot to me that fell down in my neighbor's yard, and we cut it all up and dimensioned it and been drying it, and then now that's the wood that I'm learning how to turn it with. When it was a tree, it's the tree that my wife and I met under. So that's why it means a lot. And then it just, whatever, needed to come down. And so I ran over there. Actually, I called up Bernie, and I'm like, they're cutting down a really important tree. He's like, I'll be right there. Like 10 minutes later, he and I are there, and we're like stopping the tree cutting guys and being like, can you cut me some wood this big? And they're like, sure, crazy lady.
Better to go slow than fast.
We were dimensioning some wood, so we had gotten the branch or trunk, or I don't know what part of the tree it was, and we were splitting it open, and right before we opened, he's like you're about to see something that only God knows what it looks like. Split it open, it was beautiful. It was this all this yellowy mulberry stuff. It's similarly here, like we don't know what this is going to look like once we turn it down, and I mean it could be useless or it could be beautiful. Yeah. We're about to find out.
You don't know until you stop. And that's a good piece of wood right in there. I firmly believe that the future of traditional woodworking with hand tools and combination of hand tools and power tools, you know, is in the hands of amateurs. It's what craftsmen have done there forever.
That story was produced by reporter Leslie Griffey. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Smomasni ust, kerya pust.
Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? To tell you more, here's KALW's Carrie Spivak.
I'm in a large room filled with people sitting at tables covered with platters of cold cuts, sauerkraut, and carafes of wine. At the front of the hall, a man stands alone, playing a button accordion and starts to sing. One by one, people leave their seats and join him to sing Slovenian folk songs. This is a religious holiday kicking off Lent, a cultural celebration, and a blood sausage dinner. Welcome to the annual Pust dinner at the Slovenian Hall.
Pust basically is our Mardi Gras. And so we put this on right before Ash Wednesday, which will be next week.
That's Chris Shobar, a member of the Slovenian Hall Board.
And I think it's been going on for maybe more than 80 years.
Pust is a chance for the Slovenian community to return to its roots. Chris's family came to America from Slovenia after World War I. When they arrived in San Francisco in the early 1900s, Slovenian immigrants wanted a place where they could meet and preserve their culture. They converted this old PG&E substation high atop Potrero Hill into the Slovenian Hall.
And we took it over as the hall for the community. And now it is the hall for a number of different Slovenian groups.
In the early years, Slovenian groups provided families with life insurance and death and disability insurance, since employers wouldn't provide this to immigrants. They helped new arrivals find jobs and housing. Now they offer Slovenian language classes, put on cultural events, and show Slovenian movies like the box office hit Petelini Zajtrk, literally translated as Rooster's Breakfast.
This place has always been the focal point for a lot of family gatherings.
I was born right here down the block, Vermont Street.
Irina Bear is 89 years old. She says she's always thought of the hall as a second home.
My grandpa was the founding member of this hall. Yeah, Aloysius. What a name. Aloysius Staria.
This year, she came to Pust with her daughter and granddaughter. All three generations of women in this family remember coming as little girls and falling asleep on the benches while their parents danced late into the night. These days, Irene doesn't come for the dancing.
You could have pork roast if you want, but it's the blood sausage. That's why we're here, and they make it here.
2 days ahead, volunteers start making the sausages at 6 a.m. This year, they made over 700 pounds of sausage to feed almost 200 people. I asked Joe Rosenberger, one of the volunteers, what makes these sausages so special.
Lots of blood, seven gallons of blood.
It's pig's blood that give these thick sausages their distinctive dark brown color. When I first saw them on a platter, I thought they were pumpernickel bagels. Joe explains that historically, sausages were a working class food.
Blood sausage was what the peasants ate. The people who ran the manor house, they ate the chops and the loins and the good parts. What was left over went to the peasants. The blood and the ears and the snouts.
Pust literally comes from the word pustiti, which means to leave or to quit. This is one of the last opportunities for those who observe Lent to eat meat. Board member Diane Fabian Brainy tells me there's a Slovenian saying.
Smamasni ust, kjerja pust. We have greasy mouths because it's pust.
After dinner and folk songs, people help clear the halls of tables and chairs. A polka band takes the stage and the floor fills with dancing couples. Considering what everyone just ate, I am genuinely impressed by their speed and grace.
The accordion, of course, is the central instrument, but you hear lots of other instruments. Like if you look up there on stage, you'll see, there's a friend of ours, Jože, he's got a mandolin out, right? And you'll see electric guitar and bass and so on.
Blair Kilpatrick is a third generation Slovenian. For her, Pust is about something more than the blood sausage or the polka.
It allows us to connect with our heritage, which is an immigrant heritage. And I think that in these times, it's so important for us all to remember that.
Although immigration is a topic that's been in the news a lot lately, Blair's one of the few people who wants to talk about current events. And when it comes to maybe the most prominent Slovenian immigrant in America today, Chris Schobar says,
you know, we like Melania as well. I mean, just at least for the fact that she's put us on the map, that we know that Slovenia is not Slovakia.
Irina Bear and her daughter and granddaughter are a bit more enthusiastic about the First Lady Melania Trump.
She's so beautiful. You know, Trump's wife is Slovenian. Did you know that?
Trump's wife. The president.
Trump's wife is, well, naturally, she comes from good blood.
If Melania Trump is looking for a taste of home, she may want to stop by Slovenian Hall for next year's Pust dinner. As they say in Slovenian, dober tek, good eating. Na slovenskem domu u San Francisco, sem Karis Spivak za Cross Currents.
Well, no one was able to guess the answer this week, but fear not, we'll have a new Audiograph mystery sound next week. Ready for your sneak listen?
I think a lot of people don't realize that singing in this chorus is a political statement in and of itself.
If you think you know what that was and where we recorded it, give us a call and tell us. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And that's all for Cross Currents today. Our team includes Josiah Luis Aldorete, Lila Day, Nina Gensler Debs, Chris Hoff, Nicole Grigg, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Greer McVeigh, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Zach Bateman and the Coal Mines. The Oakland Band will be joined by many others taking part in a concert for peace this weekend. That's Saturday at the Fireside Lounge in Alameda. The event starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
There's a strange, strange part of me that wants to live alone, wants to wander aimlessly without ever home. Wants to live in agony and wants to feel the fear. Strange, strange part of me. Tell a lie, wants to see how far it goes before they realize. Strange, strange part of me that wants to lose control, wants to say the wrong thing just to see how it'll go.